We are in 9 countries, 19 cities, 500 employees. We manage over $80 billion of capital. So we have been, and have always been from the beginning, we were purpose-built for very large families. And what we felt was really missing was an organization to be structured to serve the most complex set of needs.
Are you seeing that with these wealth families, or actually when you get to a certain size, is that their perspectives, whether they're located in Singapore, Germany, or, you know, Dallas, are actually quite similar?
As we've grown, we've made sure that we get better. We're not just bigger. We continue to improve as we operate. And that ultimately, that scale really accrues to the benefit of our clients. We've got to go back to what it is that made you do this in the first place, and why you think you're right. Then you really can build a business.
The business of wealth management remains a compelling and highly competitive industry, with multiple players jostling for a slice of this vast and growing ocean of assets. It's estimated that the investable wealth in the US and Europe alone is over $150 trillion, and the wealth management revenue attached to this is immense. Whilst the major banks jostle for important holds, there are also organizations whose focus is exclusively on that wealth management segment. Today's guest firm is one of these, Alti Tiedemann, whose aim is to be one of the largest non-bank wealth managers. Listed on NASDAQ, managing over $80 billion, and with Allianz as a strategic shareholder, today we welcome CEO and co-founder Mike Tiedemann. Mike, you're in from New York. Welcome to London.
Thank you, Simon. It's great to be here.
Well, I think you have come out of being in an entrepreneurial family. Just give us a sense of what that really was like.
Well, being the son of a serial entrepreneur, he and I co-founded with two other partners the business. He was 74 years old, so someone who had his early partner, Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette, and really always looked at starting a business to cure something that was missing, a service or just something that could be done better or differently. And so as he invested, and as the Tiedemann Investment Group invested various different service offerings in finance, wealth was one that was much more personal to him and his family and his personal experience. So it went all the way back to the Great Depression. His grandfather on his mother's side was the chairman of American Tobacco, so Lucky Strike cigarettes. And when the Great Depression ended in 1932, he passed away and then left in trust about $100,000, which coming out of the Great Depression in 1932 was a tremendous sum of money. Roll the clock forward 40 years, his mother passes, 72, and it was $100,000. So he had seen the lack of creativity, the lack of investment talent in the trust system, and he said, there's got to be a better way to have an institution that deals with transfer and transitions of wealth through generations that allows better investment, better service. And as he complained to people about his experience, they had their own versions. And he said, let's start a trust company, a modern trust company. And that was really the origin of the business in the late 90s, as we talked about it. And he was witnessing all the banks merging and a lot of consolidation and watching the service model collapse. So it was really interesting. We had a blank slate to start the business, and that was really the starting point. But the entrepreneurial spirit of my father and sort of what I saw from him, it goes on in the business today.
I think did he end up as chairman of DLJ? Or
he was president of DLJ, and led them through the 70s, which was obviously it was a dynamic time in the industry and certainly within that firm.
And your point about 100,000 being 100,000, of course, is in nominal terms. And yes, we're going to talk about in a minute, the biggest objective for any family is to preserve their wealth in real terms.
Yes.
And you then, I think, moved to Brazil for a while, country that knows all about the erosion of purchasing power. Was that informative?
It sure was. And it was at the extreme edge of erosion with inflation. When I arrived in Brazil, the first months in 1994, and I was fresh off the plane, I was the only American working for an incredible firm called Garantia. The partners, the founders of Garantia now run 3G, which own InBev and various consumer brands globally. Incredibly successful, smart people. The inflation monthly was 34% inflation a month. So it was compounding. So there were all these protective indices. And what you witness is the only people were protected from that were the wealthy. And so what you had was the wealth gap explosion. You're now beginning to see that in the first world. You're beginning to see that in the States. You're beginning to see that really, and it creates political divides, and it creates really an erosion of the middle class, which is something that is very dangerous within society. But I saw that in spades in Brazil. And then they changed the Real plan, and that really began to stabilize inflation.
Yes, and we talked before we started today about the late strategist Barton Biggs, who was so revered, and he did make the point, and we might come back to it, is that so many families have been too complacent about exogenous threats and other things, you know, and have paid the price. And so it's going to weave into your investment approach, you know, in a second. But before we get to Alti, I think you also studied psychology.
I do.
And I smiled when I read that, because Nicolai Tangen, who's head of the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, talked about why it was such an important sort of, you know, ingredient to being a successful investor. Now, it sounds like you had a master plan. Was that actually the case?
No, absolutely not. I enjoyed the course. I think I'm in a human capital business dealing with families, and it is understanding the importance of emotional intelligence as a leader in terms of how you communicate with people that work for you, or as you deal with families, as you relate to people across, you know, different ages, what have you. I think it is helpful, provided a structural framework. But it really was just simply I found the courses to be more interesting and the professors to be more engaging. So that was my personal journey, but it has been helpful.
Remind me, where did you study?
Ohio Wesleyan University.
Okay, so let's move to Alti Tiedemann. You are today the CEO, but you were the co-founder, as you said. Just give us the business today, facts, figures, people, locations.
Yeah, we are in 9 countries, 19 cities, 500 employees. We manage over 80 billion of capital. We have 800 families. So we have been, and have always been from the beginning, we were purpose-built for very large families. And what we felt was really missing was an organization to be structured to serve the most complex set of needs. Many of that, or in many cases, it's cross-border. There are families who have assets, or through marriage, perhaps their children are cross-border marriages. These are people that are really focused much more beyond sort of quarterly results. They're thinking in decades, not in years. And they're really also struggling with issues, not just about how to preserve their money and worry about inflation. They're thinking about what this wealth will do to the next set of generations and what responsibilities come with that, opportunities come with that. And we sit as an advisor helping them think through all of those. And the decisions we make today are really pronounced 40, 50-year outcomes in terms of structure, so tax and estate planning, and then obviously the investments and the utilization of private markets and the various options that we have.
So there is this great wealth transfer taking place in across the West, particularly. I think the U.S. number might be over 150 trillion, and yes, it's more than 200, you know, globally. I started in the business in the 1980s with Citibank's private bank, and I've seen its, you know, evolution, which we're going to talk about when it comes to, you know, the product. But let's just talk about the client. What do clients want?
Well, for starters, they need an organization that they never have to have any consideration for trust. So the clients we're dealing with have typically had an experience either in their businesses as they've generated their wealth, or with financial institutions where that something has chipped away at the trust, that the institutional trust they have. So number one, they need to really understand that every single piece of advice they are getting is the best advice on behalf of that family, given by the advisors that they're working with and the organization that they're working with. So from day one, we set out to have one fee stream transparently paid to us by our clients to provide this holistic advice. And that is whether it be accounting and tax related, obviously investment related, service related, anything to do with their family. Any single bit of advice that we're giving is collectively the best advice of the firm, and then thus through the individual they're receiving it that works for the company. So trust is the foundation of the business and will always be the foundation of the business. And then beyond that, there are services, but that's really the mechanical side. It's what are people looking to do to execute the things that they're needed for their families. And then it's an exploration related to what What's the purpose of wealth? What do families care about? There's the next generations might have guilt or fear. The parents might have fear that the wealth they've created will destroy the work ethic of their next kids or distort the way they perceive their world. So philanthropy gets woven into families and how we work with them and guide them. Impact investing is a hugely important area in terms of discussing how you can make investments that drive positive change within society. So there's a lot of nuance that comes through this, but it begins, there's the platform of trust, then the services that really expand the ways you can help and work and build further trust. And then there really is the exploration of discovering what the purpose of wealth is.
So I think it could be argued that wealth management as an industry is somewhat monochrome. And so I am intrigued in this differentiation because everybody's got their, you know, their approach. And, you know, the bigger you are, the harder it gets. You know, if you were to say, what are the one or two things that you have tried to bake into the ethos of the firm to differentiate it, what might they be?
Yeah, a focus on permanence. We've never built the business to build and sell. It was never a practice. We were always building an institution set up to serve families for multiple generations. So our starting and ending points will be with that as the framework in which we think and the framework in which we serve our families. In terms of how we present ourselves, we've always been focused on the highest end of the market. We're one of the highest, you know, largest sort of set of clients globally that exist. And then our service model, we've from day one been big users of and very successful investors in alternatives, private markets, and we're now global. So we operate throughout the U.S., Europe, and Asia. We're in Hong Kong, Singapore, all throughout Europe, and obviously throughout the States as well.
So I'm going to come back to both where you are and what you do, but I want to just pick up on that earlier point, which is something that maybe those of us of a certain generation aren't thinking about, which is what the next generation want. Yeah. And you've hinted at the concerns that I'm going to say my generation, although I'm not in this grouping, want. But let's just talk about what you're seeing, hearing from this next generation.
It's a tricky time. I mean, you think about what, you know, where I'm 54, and I, you know, I've sort of spanned the change of technological advances where I had, you know, a phone where you'd spin the dial, and, you know, if you messed up halfway through, you had to start over. And to obviously cell phones where I can just tell my phone to call someone and it will do it for me. So what you see now is the generations have visibility into what's happening in the world. So we're living in this digital world with this transparency, and wealth is much more transparent. No one knew what someone had. Now you can Google the wealth of your friend's parents and the value of their homes. Everything is overly transparent. So wealth with that, extreme wealth, and that's really what we're talking about, are these very, very wealthy families. The next generation see that as, with, in some ways, great pride, because they see the work that the generations above them have done in order to receive that wealth or to generate that wealth. But they also, there are a lot of conflicts. And there's views, there's an understanding, and maybe a deeper understanding of the wealth gap that's in the societies in which they live, or certainly developing elsewhere, the cost of healthcare and basic needs, the gaps in education that exist. So there are a lot of dynamics that the next generations see that pose either an opportunity for them to do something with their capital, and that's where impact investing comes in, whether you're making ed tech or climate. Climate is a huge issue that everyone cares about. And there are solutions being developed, and they're all underpinned by technology. I think that's probably the biggest misnomer, is that impact investing is sort of philanthropic investing. It's not. It's all underpinned by technology, and there are more and more well-trained, properly trained investors that have now entered the space. That's probably the biggest change of the last decade. So the next generations that we're dealing with want that engagement, and then you have a very interesting conversation about what the purpose of the capital is and what capital is going to be investing in. And you have the financial returns, and then you have the non-financial returns. And that's a really interesting dynamic that I've witnessed that brings and bridges, in some cases, the conversation about wealth between generations.
That's, you know, that's a whole, almost a sort of a subset of a podcast, which is fascinating. If we stay with your architecture, this is an industry where you are offering multiple asset classes, and it's difficult to be good at all of them. When you think about when and where you're passive versus active, what are the rules of the road that you have developed?
The equity market structure has changed, and it's somewhat undeniable, and it poses some opportunities as an investor. So passive investing can no longer be dismissed. I don't think there's any wealth manager in the world that doesn't integrate either fully or quite heavily passive investing, indexation. And so the capital flows continue to mount, and you actually are taking proper risk by not having passive index exposure. Now, and there are also some very creative, tax-effective, tax harvesting strategies that are index linked as well. So that segment of the market is undeniable and is important. And it's also, it's a proper asset, meaning a beneficial asset for families. As you move down market cap and off the shores of developed worlds, there's a much, much more valid and proper argument for active management and selection, quality selection, as opposed to indexation. Because in many cases in the emerging markets, commodities will end up being the lead, or throughout history, commodity-oriented companies will be the lead or the large percentages of the indices, as opposed to perhaps consumer plays or financial plays or tech plays that you may want to have more exposure to.
Okay, and when we look at that private asset pool, we've had recently the president of Ares and the president of Apollo. We know these firms are sort of going headlong into the individual space, and individuals, for better or worse, are going to end up with a larger slice of their asset allocation in those private assets. You have the luxury of sitting above that from an asset allocation standpoint. So tell me a little bit about how you think about the private debt, private equity, where and when, and that hedge funds as well, which you know very well.
We do. We're very lucky. One of our largest shareholders, and you referenced it earlier, is Allianz, and they invested into us. And their view was had not been, and still has yet to be, other than us, an insurance and wealth combination. And they took investments into us because they work with very large families. They've been around 100 plus years. And so they work with these very large generations in the Mittelstand in Germany and all over Europe and really all over the world. And they don't have a wealth offering internally. They have incredible asset management. They manage $3 trillion in total. I mean, they're just enormous. We are partnering with them in private credit. They're the largest allocator in the world in private credit. They've been doing it for as long as anyone. And so as we looked at that and we said, can we do something together? And we are essentially co-investing alongside them in private credit. We've created a structure where we retain the governance around it, and we have a contractual right to invest in anything they're doing. What's interesting about that is their scale is extreme. The fees they have negotiated because they have got such scale are as low as anyone. That we pass along to our clients. But what's most interesting is the secondary investing they do, where they're able to buy at discounts. And so that to us is how we try to create a competitive moat using our scale, but most importantly, combining it with, in this case, with Allianz. And you can create something that just doesn't exist, where you have incredible risk oversight. You have governance structure that works for our clients and for our business. And then you have the benefit of much lower fees and secondaries and co-investments and all the things that really ultimately drive a lot of alpha.
And sitting where you do, you are obviously dealing with the blockages in the world of PE and the expectations that some of us who might be more cynical would say, are quite full, those expectations of future returns. Don't want to be too tactical, but how do you approach that slice of the asset allocation pie?
Sure. Well, for starters, I personally believe the single greatest risk to private equity investing is vintage risk. All things equal, meaning manager quality equal and segment that you're investing in. What you can't control is, are you unknowingly investing heavily in the wrong vintage, that wrong 1 or 2 year period where they're deploying capital and And the next 10 years will not be. It will be a terrible period, that sort of shoulder that you really don't want to be investing in. So we try to make sure that we're allocating across managers and in a quite diversified manner. So we're not just pouring into growth equity or tech. We're investing in hard assets. We're investing in, you know, some consumer, some financial. I mean, we really spread we diversify our private equity investments, and then we spread the vintage risk. So that's right now we're at a period where the public markets are no longer a great outlet for PE, and you're actually seeing within the listed, previously private businesses, you're seeing the overhang of the private equity blocks in these stocks, really good businesses, down 60-70%. And then once they fall past a certain mid-cap range in the small cap, they just continue to sort of drift lower. And there's a clearing that needs to happen, and that in public markets. I don't know when that will happen, but until it does, you're going to have this exit challenge for private equity.
How one thinks about the suite of investment choices that wealthy families will make in conjunction with firms like yours, is it possible for a business to have, using Warren Buffett's term, a moat?
I think there is. And I think so first of all, we want to create a brand that is aspirational, that very large families want to be part of. They want to be part of a community of global large families. And we see that more and more as being truly important and differentiating. In terms of how we execute the business, the reinvestment into the business, so retaining your great talent, the depth of that talent, the access and pricing power that you gain with scale needs to accrue to your clients. So we're very intentional about that, and we have been since. As we've grown, we've made sure that we get better. We're not just bigger. We continue to improve as we operate, and that ultimately, that scale really accrues to the benefit of our clients. So the competitive moat is everything from all of those, plus systems, plus capabilities. And the way in which we're organized is that we have essentially this global repository of information, project work, investment, tax work, all the different things that these complex families are doing. We have the knowledge base internally. And with each project, each new family that comes and has something complex that we help them solve, that then becomes sort of, scar tissue for the next family or the next prospect to come in and benefit from.
So you are operating in these various geographies. You've talked about the Allianz connection. You also acquired the Contora family office in Germany. You're in Singapore with AL Wealth.
Yeah.
One of the challenges for the global wealth management business has been these different jurisdictions have all of these attendant tax regimes, and so you can't get the synergies that you might like in some of the things. It was one of the reasons Morgan Stanley sold off to Credit Suisse its wealth management business that I used to know very well because of all those complexities. How do you think about dealing with these various geographies that have these requirements?
So you have to have the combination of local expertise, local service, tax structure, currency, language. I mean, that all has to be at the quality of the global firm at the local level. And then the benefit of being global and local has to come from the platform. The benefit of scale comes from the global platform, the investment team, the investment opportunities. How the local teams interface and which portions of that are to the benefit of the clients really are done locally. And so there's a quality governance that is global. There's the access and the scale, the benefit of scale that we make sure remains global. But it's ultimately the local teams that are really providing the nuanced delivery of that to their client base on the ground. So we try to create centers of excellence. And what I mean by that are service areas. In the U.S., it's in Delaware, where we have our trust powers, and we have our largest single office. And then we're building for Europe and really to serve Asia as well. We're building our presence in Lisbon. So that's our fastest growing office. And there's great investment talent. There's portfolio management. We're hiring procurement people and tech and finance support down there.
And for those of us who have observed risk appetite in these jurisdictions, one would have said that Germany, for example, always a bond heavy culture, equity averse, that's very different from the UK largely because of inflationary experiences.
Yeah.
Are you seeing that with these wealth families, or actually when you get to a certain size, is that their perspectives, whether they're located in Singapore, Germany, or, you know, Dallas, are actually quite similar?
That is a great question. I would say there are embedded differences, and I do not believe it's our job to try to drive change to their comfort. Yep. And so if you have someone, a client in Brazil or a client in Argentina, or someone that's Japanese, or you, as you go around the world and you begin looking at their views on currency risk or their views on inflation that go back 40 or 50 years and learned experience, it is not our job to impose. It's our job to advise on our view of economic and, you know, inflationary views currently, and maybe currency views currently. But ultimately, if they want to have a segment of their portfolio that is anchored in protection, we need to just make sure that we can execute that at the highest level and at the lowest cost possible. I mean, that, so there is a reflection back to the clients of what it is that they want. And we spend a lot of time when we're beginning to work with families to really discuss what is the proper investment policy statement by entity, and then working with a family to understand the 20-year view of that. And then, you know, obviously updating and adjusting it over time and making sure that it's current. And there are times when families 3 and 5 years in begin to feel a little bit more trusting of, you know, taking more risk or different types of risk. And they allow you, there's an education that comes with that. There's a conversation, there's a lot of transparency. We're not pushing or selling anything to anyone. So the conversation is always about, are there different ways to do things and what are other families doing? Yep. And that's, I think, what we're seeing now being global. And then we've only been global for 5 years in total, but really at this scale for about 3 years. And you're beginning now to see families in Germany or in Singapore or in Hong Kong say, well, what are the families in the UK doing? What is the UK asking about the US, et cetera? So you're beginning to see more sharing of information and sort of questioning of what other jurisdictions are doing.
Right. And behind that, of course, for large family wealth, and I sit on the investment committees with which I'm associated, is the big question is the currency reference. Yeah. Because you could be a Brazilian Cruzeiro reference, you know, allocator and look heroic nominally, yeah, you know, in a weak currency environment. But as the dollar is getting some more attention and is, you know, overvalued versus purchasing power parity and all of the attendant issues that are related to, you know, the administration, are you seeing more discussions amongst families about what's the right way they should ultimately account for their wealth?
Without a doubt. And I would say in the U.S., we've had the great privilege of the dollar being the global currency. And I would say earlier this year in April, when the Liberation Day, was it called? When that period happened, you saw for the first time equity and bond markets sell off and the dollar sell off. Yeah. Typically, you had equity markets sell off and people would repatriate into the dollar. The dollar would strengthen and act as almost a hedge against portfolios. So I think the world woke up to the fact that this is a dollar risk currently. And the administration has been promotional of Bitcoin and sort of diversification. They've wanted to intentionally, structurally weaken the dollar. I think that's I understand the logic. I don't have to agree with it. It's not, but I think that's a very dangerous game. I think it's an incredible privilege to have your currency be the world's currency, and I don't know why we would do anything as a country to diminish that.
It was just the late French president Giscard d'Estaing who referred to it as the exorbitant privilege. We hope, and we think we are having Scott Besson back on the show, so maybe I'll reserve that question for him. When we think about the tax and trust advice, you hinted at it early on, incredibly important, again, very fractured given its sort of geographic, but how have you built expertise and competence there?
Yeah, you know, and I'm happy you asked that question because it's not as much of a focus as it should be. And what I mean by that is in the States, and we've had since day one, we started as a trust company, and we were trying to solve for that multi-generational combination of fiduciary services with investment services. And we have seen incredible benefit of having them combined. So you have an investment advisor that works with a team, with a family, and then sitting next to the fiduciary counsel. When someone joins us, the first thing we're doing is reviewing everything they've done with their estate plan to date, all of their assets, where they're owned, what the tax ramifications are. And then we walk through what happens when each one of the parents passes and the capital begins to flow into the entities or to the government in the form of taxes or to a foundation, perhaps. But we map that out, and what we've been able to do is get families. There's an exhaustion point when a family is talking about their death and they're talking to their lawyer, and every time they pick up the phone, it costs them $10,000 to talk to their lawyer, and they've given enough money. Whatever it is, people get tired of talking about that. But the importance of structuring and then the investment selection that go into certain entities, all of that is something that can be managed over time, and it's an enormous source of alpha. We do that in a combined, single, sort of one-team approach in the U.S. Off the shores of the U.S., it's totally different. It is an embedded view that fiduciary and investment should be separate organizations. And it's not our job necessarily to fight the world's opinion of that. I just think they're wrong. I've just seen the proper benefit of having these organizations or teams working closely together and doing it consistently over time, because interest rates are changing or the tax rates are changing, the estate tax policies are changing. And as you're able to respond to that and do it in a very coordinated fashion and having teams working together, it's just the benefits to the next generation are profound. And so thank you for asking. It's an important point.
And I think you're right. It is often not addressed, and there's a reason that Chinese expression is sandals to sandals in three generations, because in part it is sometimes suboptimal, you know, planning ahead. You're a public company, listed on the Nasdaq, as we discussed earlier on. How do you weigh up the merits and demerits of being, you know, a public company? I think I'm right in saying that nearly 90% of the ownership is employees.
Yeah, it's not quite that high, but that would have been virtually impossible to do as a private business. So we are a big believer in alignment. We're a big believer in equity ownership and an equity culture, and that we believe drives great behavior as a firm. So the opportunity to list and to be global, and it was really a push to become more global. And when we think about the challenges of being an immature public company, a small cap stock, there are very few natural buyers for small cap stocks these days. So it's really an index and then some people that might have a view in a sector. But what we've been able to do is create a governance structure, so a proper board and incredible processes. Going into next year, we expect to be SOX compliant, which really means that we have a control environment, a financial control environment, an operating environment that is at the highest standards. So we've made investments in infrastructure that we never would have done as a private business. So we have a consolidated tech stack globally, marketing team globally, investment platform globally. We've done all of this to create the architecture for a permanent organization at great expense. And then now that the cost of investment begins to roll off and the business begins to now drive towards higher profitability and really more sustainability, and then we can focus and orient ourselves around growth and adding team and deepening the teams in various locations in which we operate.
There isn't a day that goes past where AI isn't in the conversation. I see Vista Equity Partners, who have been on the show some time back, were announcing today a reduction in headcount because of, you know, changes the process as good as if AI. How do you think it may impact a business like yours over the coming years?
Yeah, I think it will do many things. First, for starters, all of the, whether it be Microsoft Copilot or Adapar or Salesforce or Box, they all have AI agents working. So there's a horizontal approach. AI is already being involved. And if you think about quant or robo-investing, when you put it, place an order, there's an algo, you know, trading that order. So it's already in the business. I mean, and you're beginning to see the influence. What it does drive is productivity. It begins to allow a junior or aspiring advisor to spend less time in spreadsheets and more time actually understanding the investments and maybe perhaps reading the research about the investments, the portfolio, more time doing essentially higher value service. So there is, I think, a true benefit to the ability to improve the workforce and the actual work that is being done for your employees. There's also no question that it should reduce the human need in certain roles. How that plays out over a 10 and 20 year period in terms of headcount will be seen. I do think it will create, no question, more efficiency in terms of operating the business. And so your orientation of where you sit within a firm probably needs to orient more and more around the service and the skills being provided and the personalities and the ways in which you can interface with families.
I think it was Rob Arnott when we interviewed him last year, research affiliate, said when his team had come to him, maybe it was even a year and a half before that, so 2 years ago, and said, you know, is AI going to sort of, you know, make us redundant? He said, AI won't make you redundant unless you fail to know how to use it. So
there's no question. I mean, it's incredible to see people that are using it really as almost like a work staff of 10, 15 people. I think if you're starting a business de novo today, yeah, there's no question that that would be the starting point of your infrastructure, really.
I got three more rapid questions. One is around culture. You acquire these businesses. It's hard. What do you spend most of your thinking and actual time on when it comes to culture?
Culture is, so a fiduciary culture, we are, you know, you look at within the financial industry, there's a huge amount of transaction focus. That is not our business. The people that have that in their DNA will not be great in our business. Fiduciary advisors are people who think about working with a family for as long as humanly possible. So there's a duration in their thinking. There's a caretaking in their thinking. The value of the relationship is not a what can be done today. It is what can I do with this family over 20, 30 years. So that is a mindset, and that is ultimately the culture and the embedded culture in these firms that have joined us over time. We are not a roll-up firm. We've made acquisitions, strategic acquisitions, and it's really strategic partnerships. And when you find these firms that have a focus on the highest end of the market, that limits the number of people we would be able to find in the marketplace. These are firms that were set up with the same ethos that we had, and we fully integrate them. And integration means different things to different people. There's some arduous parts of it, systems and HR and all of the mechanics and what have you, but cultural integration and understanding exactly how the collective is better, taking some of their processes, some of the money managers they may have invested in over time, they may be better than ours, and elevating some of the people on their team to be working the global function. This is stuff that we've done and continue to do every time. It makes us a better firm, but making sure that you're committed to the integration. We were one of the first people to do acquisitions within the wealth space and really have that as a primary focus to be fully integrated. It ultimately leads to organic growth. It leads to relationship building over time. It does take time. It does cost money. But it's critically, critically important. And it ultimately goes back to driving this fiduciary culture.
Absolutely. And you touched on the next generation and impact. Obviously, there's been the ESG pendulum is swinging hard, particularly in the US, away from the super enthusiastic adoption, particularly Europe, that loves to take these things and regulate them and do all sorts of things. How are you approaching that conversation?
We really try not to swing with the political winds when it comes to investing within this space. And in general, discussing politics with clients is a bad idea. As it pertains to investment policy, and economic policy and tax. Beyond that, it's a very dangerous subject matter to discuss. But as it pertains to impact, we think the underpinnings, the investments needed and the underpinnings, if you're looking at climate alone, if you're looking at carbon sequestration strategies, applications to old industry that ultimately can begin to neutralize some of the carbon output. You look at the advent of solar. I mean, people talk about the rapid change in climate, and it really is quite alarming and uncomfortable, and I think also undeniable. But the rapid change in pace in which batteries, solar, wind, cost is declining. It's down 80% over the 10 years. China put in more solar in 2023 than the U.S. had in its entire history. So the adoption of solar is growing, and that's also in part because its effectiveness is growing and its cost is declining. So the tricky part in the States is you have, you know, the pendulum swinging of investments from government and investments out. I think families take a longer view, and the families also, at times when the political push is against the space, their resolve actually, it's like, you know what, this space needs our capital. And so there are families who take that approach. Let's say, look, we're doing this for the next 30, 40 years, and we're already seeing the non-financial results as well as the financial results that are adequate to continue to reinvest. So when you give your money away, it's gone. When you invest in a space, if it's socially oriented and you recapture your capital, you can do it again. So there's this recycling of money within the spaces in which people invest. And that's a dynamic, I think, that sometimes gets lost in the conversation.
So a few closing questions for you. And let's just start off with a really simple one. If we have this conversation sitting here in 5+ years, what defines success for you?
Success for me would, there's an internal and external answer to that. Internally would be continuing to retain our great people and clients. And they're very much linked, but continuing to prove that we can operate our business and our culture globally and at the highest level. Externally, I would say that our brand would be synonymous with the highest quality brand. So when someone would intern and they would have that on their resume, it would be a stamp of quality. And the same would be true with any family or foundation endowment that works with us. I think of the experience as being one that they're very proud of, and ultimately we create a brand that is known for that and only known for that.
And if you were looking at that crystal ball of the structure of financial markets, particularly around how individuals are served, might it not change very much in the next decade?
I think the delivery of information and the transparency of information that people will get will only continue to increase. So how they see it, how the ease of that information being transmitted to them should change. It should not be me with a flip book once a quarter, or it really should be at your fingertips. And so, and now then the security around that information. So cybersecurity is a risk that you only talk about when there's an event. It is something we invest heavily in. We spend millions of dollars on our cybersecurity because the information of our families is incredibly important to keep private. And as you go across jurisdictions, there are different regulations. And so this is an area of investment that you need to continue. It's also a barrier to entry. To be a global firm, you need to have scale and you need to make these investments. But when I think about it, what will change for families, I would hope that there will be the conversations between generations about their capital and the opportunities and responsibilities they have to deploy that in manners that ultimately make them proud and within structures that really enable that to go forward and to drive a lot of positive change. I think the wealth in private markets or in private hands can be used to drive positive change in the future without sacrificing results and without really having it being staying away from politics and being able to really be a counterbalance to some of the inflationary trends and the wealth gap. These are seriously problematic issues. And I believe our client base and others have a real opportunity to be, you know, part of solutions that can be developed over time.
You kindly attended our Money Maze Allocator Summit back in October.
I would highly recommend it to anyone.
Thank you. Well, we're going again next October, again there. At London Stock Exchange. And you asked the question I'm going to ask you again because it was such a good answer. So you better remember what you said, which is what's the greatest lesson you've learned in your career?
I would say that when you're an entrepreneur, you have to, and you think that you're going to build something in a window of time. That window of time probably should extend quite longer than you'd expect, number one. Number two, you've got to be resilient. In your darkest days, you've got to go back to what it is that made you do this in the first place and why you think you're right. And if you can have that resilience and you can have a duration of thinking that is just longer perhaps than you originally had in your business plan, then you really can build a business. And there are people who have short-term luck and have had tremendous success, so taking nothing away from them. But most businesses have to go through cycles. And as you go through those cycles, you're going to be learning the whole way. And you really only learn from your mistakes. So I think resilience, duration, and humility, I think ultimately, the thing that has been lost in our generation. I was lucky enough to have a father who was successful and very humble and treated as he walked in the door every day. The bigger the gap that he had in stature or importance between he and the person he was talking to, the warmer he was. And I think a little bit of that has been lost in the younger generation. So having some humility and resilience are two important qualities.
And talking of warmth, my final question, is it true, as I did my research, that one of your important activities every week is hot yoga?
No, but I do have a good story about Bikram. You remember the famous controversial, my first and ever yoga class was taught by Bikram in Los Angeles. I was there, and if you've never done a hot yoga class, bring a few towels. And I was in the back, and he was very charismatic, somewhat abusive, yelling at everyone. I was like, this doesn't seem like yoga. But he finally picked on me because I was breathing the wrong way. And it was at the very end of the class, and the entire class turned around and looked at me as I did the inverse of what I was supposed to be doing. But no, I don't. I love saunas. And I do stretch in the saunas, but I don't do much in the way of yoga.
So, Mike, it's been really interesting learning about Alti Tiedemann and your business, and I'm going to take away three particular things. One is there is this vast wealth transfer happening, which is running to over $200 trillion, but the most important point is that the newer wealth is thinking about purpose in a way that maybe the previous generation did it. And with that comes some really important investment and non-investment considerations. Number one. Number two is that we talk about trusts and we talk about structures, but perhaps it's never been more important for families as they think about protecting real wealth and generational transfers to spend more time on that because we are all very transactional and the structural part of this decision-making is absolutely paramount. And finally, just it's life advice, but I am going to repeat it, is resilience, duration, humility, three great qualities. So it's been great having you here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. This was a pleasure.
This is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice, an offer to buy or sell any financial product, a solicitation to become an advisory client of Alti or an investor of any Alti-advised fund or an endorsement of Alti, its advisory service or investment strategies, including Alti-advised funds. While the information and views presented here are believed to be accurate and expressed in good faith, there is no assurance that they are correct, complete or will not change over time. All investments carry risks, including loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results.